Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hello, friends, and thank you for joining us once again for the Saturday Frights podcast. Since we've hit our 50th episode of the podcast, we are giving each segment of George A. Romero and Stephen King's 1982 classic Creepshow a proper discussion this week. For today, we'll be taking a look at the second segment from the movie entitled The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill.
Yes, the weakest offering from the anthology, in my humble opinion.
I'm not going to agree with that, projectionist, but I'm so very glad you've already come out of the gate swinging at this segment. I definitely think that this is the story that has the most laughs. Dark laughs at that, up to a point.
I would be willing to bet that our dear listeners will feel the same way as I do, Victor.
And I'm sure they'll chime in once we post this. Well, unlike with Father's Day, The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill was an adaptation of a previous Stephen King story. In this case, the short story entitled Weeds, which was originally published in the men's magazine Cavalier in May of 1976. The change in the title was a nod to Bob Dylan's 1963 protest song, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, which was written in anger over the death of the very real 51-year-old barmaid named Hattie Carroll. As we mentioned in the Father's Day episode, the Creepshow segments begin and end as images of a comic book. I mean, if you pause the film, you can read the word balloons, or in the case of The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill, just before its story begins, you can read a letters page for the comic. Now, I'm going to allow the projectionist to read this because it will totally sound better in his unique voice.
Why, thank you, Sage. It will be my pleasure. It is always a treat to be allowed to entertain our dear listeners. Heaven knows you aren't capable of that. Welcome to the first pulsing, pustulant issue of Creepshow, Fiend fans. Below are some enthusiastic letters from those of you who were crazy enough to subscribe in advance. Those of you who could actually hold a pin in your claws. Hold up. This reads like Daniel 13 wrote it, Sage.
I've always assumed that our friend Dan learned how to write from old issues of Tales from the Crypt, projectionist. The letters page has actual written comments, which I think, friends, you will agree is a lot of work for about 3 seconds of actual film time. It just goes to show, though, how much love George Romero and Stephen King put into the movie. Some of those who wrote in are Brian Hall of Ann Arbor, Michigan, as well as David Graves of Spruce, Maryland. It turns out that Tabitha King's maiden name is Spruce, and David Graves was Stephen King's real-life brother-in-law until his untimely passing back in 2000. As the segment begins, we are introduced to our main protagonist, Jordy Verrill, played by author Stephen King. Jordy is...
a dimwit. I believe that is the word you were searching for, Victor.
Well, he's a little slow, and that is the truth. Jordy, decked out in a flannel shirt and torn overalls, looks quite the part of a country bumpkin. Standing near his house on the family's farm, we see a meteorite fall from the sky overhead to crash nearby in Verrill's field. Stephen King really played Jordy over the top. While he may not be well known for his acting skills...
rightfully so, considering the ridiculousness on display in the segment, dear listeners.
I was going to add that it's been reported that George Romero took King aside and suggested he play the part just like Wile E. Coyote in the Roadrunner animated shorts. You know, just as he realizes that he has stepped off another cliff. I know you don't care for this story, projectionist, but King really does deliver a slapstick performance. Eyes bulging wide and over-exaggerated hand gestures with a sometimes eye-rolling hick accent.
Continue.
Jordy rushes over to check the meteorite out and uses a folding carpenter's ruler to poke and prod at it. We the viewers see an odd color change within the rock itself. As it lays in its crater, it glows a hot orange, but quickly is replaced with a deep green hue. This doesn't stop Geordi from doing something incredibly stupid. The first of many tragic decisions, actually. Slowly, he reaches his hand out to touch the meteorite, which of course rewards him with burned and horribly blistered fingers. Viril sucks angrily on his burned digits in an attempt to cool them off. Projectionist, did you notice that just before Geordi touches the meteorite, the color reverts back to hot orange? I've always had the theory that whatever the entity, the alien life form is within the meteorite, it tricked him into touching it, possibly telepathically willing him to do so.
I will admit, I hadn't got that until you pointed it out. Interesting theory. Especially considering what occurs within the bathtub later in the film. You might be onto something, Sage.
Geordi forgets about his fingers as he begins to wonder if this cosmic arrival isn't mana from heaven, and we viewers are treated to his overactive imagination as he ponders if the college would pay for such a find.
As Victor has already mentioned, this segment of the anthology is played for dark laughs. For example, in Geordi Viril's mind, there must be a department of meteors at the local college.
During this daydream, by the way, friends, is the appearance of that marble ashtray from Father's Day. There is one other actor in The Lonesome Death of Geordi Viril, Bingo O'Malley, who plays the university professor in the daydream, as well as the physician in his nightmares, and the spirit of Geordi's deceased father. It would seem that Viril owes the bank $200, and he sees the meteorite as his best chance to pay it off. But Geordi just has to find a way to cool it off. Showing that he isn't the sharpest tool in the shed, he fills a metal bucket with cold water and throws it on the steaming meteorite.
Which, with a great geyser of purplish steam, causes it to break in half. Neatly in half, I might add. Suspicious, eh?
Geordi's imagination kicks into gear once again as he realizes what he has done. Instead of earning an easy $200 this time, the professor, with a menacing scowl, declares he wouldn't pay 2 cents for it. Geordi curses his own stupidity, even calling himself a lunkhead, and states that the Viril luck is in, and that is always bad. Reaching down into the crater, he picks up half of the now-cooled meteorite. We can see there is some kind of bluish liquid or goop in both halves of the rock. Geordi pours out the blue liquid into the crater before dropping it into the metal bucket. He repeats the same action with the second half, and after wiping the goo from the meteorite off his hands and onto his overalls, rises crestfallen at his perceived ill fortune, and begins to head back to the house. But before he leaves, he notices the liquid at the bottom of the crater as it mixes with the dirt and begins to glow a bright green. Geordi pays it no heed, wearily entering his house, mentioning that perhaps he can glue the meteorite back together in the morning. Viril is apparently planning to spend the rest of the evening relaxing by getting drunk and watching some classic rounds of wrestling on his old black and white TV.
That may be all that Geordi Viril is intending, but fate has other plans, it would seem.
Exactly. Time passes, and even though Viril isn't aware of it yet, weeds have begun to sprout around the meteorite's crater, following a trail up to the house, even growing on the metal pail that the meteorite pieces are stored in. Every spot where that odd liquid has touched has begun to grow weeds. As Geordi is about to take a swig from his bottle of Ripple Red, he freezes as he notices that where those blisters on the ends of his finger were are now growing dark green patches of something plant-like. As you can imagine, this sends him into a state of panic. We, the viewers, can see that even on his overalls, where he tried to wipe that goo off, weeds have begun to sprout. Listeners, do you recall what he did when he burned his fingers? After rushing into the bathroom, he finds that even his tongue is starting to sprout a green growth. As the evening progresses, the farmhouse and surrounding lands are covered in waist-high weeds, and this extends to Geordi as well. Half of his face is covered in what looks kind of like moss.
We might add that when he first discovered the growth on his fingers, he began to call the doctor. But that imagination you mentioned makes him feel they will have to amputate his fingers, and so he puts the phone down.
True, but I think this is a case like in 1958's The Blob. Even if he could have got to the doctor, there's nothing they could have done for him. Jordy begins to complain about itching and gives us our first clue as to just how far and fast the weeds have spread on the poor man when he decides to get out of his clothes and take a hot bath. By this point, he's already sporting a neck-deep green beard of plant life, and most of his back and chest have been covered. Jordy is halted, however, by something even more odd than the rapidly growing vegetation. The image of his deceased father appears in his bathroom mirror to scold his son for even entertaining the notion of getting into the bathtub.
Do you believe, Victor, that this is truly a visitation from the dead? Or the fool's subconscious trying to save himself?
I've always looked at it as he's being visited by his father. Honestly, friends, King deserves credit for his acting in this scene. His childlike responses, the really break your heart, and the way he behaves as his father is scolding him, I think might clue us into how stern his deceased father was. What I'm getting at is if you aren't already feeling bad for Jordy, you will now.
Jordy!
Daddy?
Jordy!
You're dead. You've been dead, Christ, 3 years almost.
You ain't gonna get in that tub, are you? Stop water there at once, Jordy. Don't you know? You get in that water, Jordy. You might as well sign your death warrant.
I'm a goner already, Daddy. Ain't I? Got the stuff out of that meteor on me. And I'm gone. Ain't I? Daddy? Daddy?
Jordy seems to wage an inner struggle, but the desire of the plants wins out and he throws himself into the tub. Like in his conversation with his father, I truly think Viral knows it's all over for him, especially after his dunk in the bathtub. As the night progresses, we are witness to the weeds truly overtaking the Viral farmland. Some areas, the weeds are as tall as corn stalks, and even within Jordy's home, everywhere you look, plant life has sprung up. On the carpet, hanging low from the ceiling, it's almost like a jungle. But there is no sign of Jordy.
Well, not as we remember him, at least. Jordy has been totally consumed by the mossy growth and is slowly, painfully dragging himself across the kitchen floor to reach something. He yanks a cloth covering back to reveal a shotgun.
We will let you hear how this plays out, friends. Because, no offense, with the title of this segment, you knew that Jordy wasn't going to make it out alive. But there is one more final bit of horror that King and Romero lay on us viewers.
Please, 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 God, let my luck be in just this once. Please, God, just this once.
And in today's weather, well, not much for the outdoor types, but you farmers are going to love this. The current 30-day forecast released by the U.S. Meteorological Station at Portland calls for moderating temperatures and lots of rain. Castle County is going to turn green so fast in the next month that it's going to be almost miraculous.
Yes, as the film image reverts to funny book form, we see that the alien vegetation has already taken root as it continues to expand down the highway.
That's right. Things don't look too good for the human race by the end of this segment.
Victor, at one point in the evening, as Jordy Viral tries to ease the fear of being transformed into some human-plant hybrid, he is watching a movie on the television. Do you happen to know what film that was?
Was it The Grapes of Wrath? There's a line about continuing to thrive under great adversity. which Geordi hears as he momentarily leaves his house and sees just how quickly the weeds are overtaking his farm.
You are wrong. But that was a good guess. It was 1937. A Star is Born, starring Janet Gaynor and Frederick March.
Huh. Well, I do know that the wrestling match that Geordi watches is a real match between Bob Backlund and I think the announcer, Vince McMahon, says it's Samoan number one. I think of the Wild Samoans duo. It's also been reported by King that the plant makeup that he wore during the segment caused him to have a very painful allergic reaction that required shots and medication to keep under control. Ouch. So, Projectionist, did our little discussion of the synopsis tonight change your mind at all about the lonesome death of Geordi Verrill?
Not in the least. Although, I will agree with you on Stephen King's performance in the bathroom scene. For a non-actor, it is quite moving.
I really don't have anything else to add, my friend. This segment is a little over 10 minutes long, so it's the shortest of the five presented in Creepshow. Do you have anything to share with the listeners before I discuss the notable cast?
I do indeed. Since you mentioned it in the Father's Day broadcast, I have selected a special treat for you.
Class, come to order, pay attention just once. We have a lesson to teach to the dunce. Is the candy good convection?
Now the safety is perfection.
Have we got a good selection?
We invite your close inspection.
Is the ice cream not delicious? Health and tasty, un-nutritious. Is the popcorn crisp and healthful?
Yeah, it is sure a muffle.
Is the soda cold and fizzy?
Vitamins keep the bubbles busy.
That's good, the lesson is learned. The trip to the sweet spa you have earned. Now is time for intermission.
Treat yourself to some nutrition.
Once courageous knights roamed the land, searching for adventure, ready to brave any challenge. Knight Riders. The knight is a fighting machine, disciplined in mind and heart, and noble to the death. Knight Riders. Action. Adventure. Romance. Heraldry. Pageantry. And magic.
Magic got to do with the soul, man. Only the soul got destiny.
Knight Riders. They ride for the crown. They fight for honor.
That kid thinks I'm evil Knievel.
That kid thinks you're William the Knight. You're his hero.
I'm not trying to be a hero. I'm fighting the dragon.
Following a dream as far as it will take them. Because a legend lives as long as someone believes.
This isn't just a roadside carny anymore. Not for some of us. It's a lot more than that. It's a whole lot more. You know that, Morgan.
You guys, it's the most fun I get in my life. I just don't see y'all break up.
You think it's breaking up?
It's money, Billy. It's all to do with money. Money makes the world go around, even your world.
Small town jails is uncomfortable places.
Damn uncomfortable.
Throw down the gauntlet. Take up the challenge. A new age begins. Romance and adventure live. Knight Riders. The legend is born.
That movie is so awesome.
Oh, I think not.
On this, Projectionist, you were wrong. Now, we talked about George A. Romero on the Father's Day segment yesterday, so there's really no need to go over that again. We do not really need to discuss the work of Stephen King, but he does have 20 credits as an actor. A few of these include 1981's Knight Riders as the Hoagie Man. Yes, he's eating a hoagie sandwich. He played a pharmacist in Tom Holland's 1996 adaptation of his novel, Thinner, and was just recently seen as a diner patron in the 2014 series, Under the Dome. Bingo O'Malley has 42 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in film and TV, such as 1987's Lady Beware with Diane Lane, 1991's TV movie The $10 Million Getaway, and Guilty Until Proven Innocent. He was in 1992's Bob Roberts as Bob Roberts Sr., and had appearances in 2000's Wonder Boys, 2010's Love and Other Drugs, and in 2011, he played Mr. Harkin in J.J. Abrams' Super 8. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode.
Hold up, Sage. We received an electronic missive from Gary Burton, who asked, Vic, I'm curious. As a horror fan, you saw many movies as a kid. Are there any films you either did not sit through entirely by your own choice, or your father removed you from while watching it?
I can recall leaving the 62 drive-in once or twice when it turned out that a movie was too mature, when I was a young child, of course. But I do not ever recall being too scared by something not to have watched it. Wait, there is one. The 62 drive-in one evening was showing the late, great Wes Craven's The Last House on the Left, and my father very quickly realized this wasn't a film I should be seeing.
Did the drive-in theater refund your money? It was, after all, clearly stated on the theatrical one sheets that it was rated R.
Oh, we didn't leave. My father just made me crawl into the back seat and go to sleep. Except I couldn't, so I listened to the entire film and was totally freaked out by what I was hearing. As an adult, I clearly remember walking out of 1999's Lake Placid, however. I've grown to really enjoy that film. I believe I even mentioned that in my review on The Retroist. But I didn't think it was going to be a comedy horror film. I thought it was going to be something awesome like 1980's Alligator. Gary, thank you for the question. What about you, projectionist? Was there ever a movie that just scared you so bad that you couldn't watch it?
Does not being able to listen to this broadcast with you as host count?
And friends, I think that does wrap up this episode. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best and frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. That is, peachy@retroist.com. Our ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys, and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
When the clock chimes 3 a.m, you must build 3 oaken caskets. Knock 3 times against them in order, and I might pop out to give you a tasty surprise. Or sometimes you can find me on the Facebooks. Projectionist Haunted Drive-In.
The Saturday Frights podcast has a Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. We will not have a new Saturday Frights podcast for Wednesday, as I'd have my shift at the Arcadia Retrocade. But on Thursday, we'll be back with Something to Tide You Over. Until then, the vault is sealed.
Holy old Jesus!
This has been a RetroWest production. Goodbye.